Hey guys, welcome to another Sunday Conversation presented by FL1 News. I'm Josh Durso, and today I'm joined by Wayne County Sheriff Barry Virts. We talked about marijuana legalization, bail reform, a lot of other New York State proposals, staffing concerns in Wayne County within the Sheriff's Office, and challenges recruiting across policing in general. You don't want to miss it. Our full conversation is coming up in less than 30 seconds. Stay tuned. Appreciate it. It's been a while. You were on, I think, a couple of years ago, but it's been a little bit, and a whole lot has gone on in Wayne County since. So thanks for taking the time to talk to us.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's nice to sit down and talk with the press and the media about some positive things that are going on, other than having to stand in front of the cameras and talk about, you know, loss of life or some doom and gloom that have happened in Wayne County. So thank you very much for having me.
And I guess the first question to sort of jump off of that. How do you guys stay resilient? How does the force stay resilient, having to deal with sort of tragedy after tragedy?
Well, you know, the Sheriff's Office, we have four major components of our operation. We have court security, the civil office, we have the jail facility, our corrections officers, and then what's showcased, what everyone sees, is our road patrol, our criminal investigators, and our deputies. And everyone at the Sheriff's Office, all 198 employees, just do a stellar job and have been utmost professionals as we do our work.
So obviously a couple months ago we had Chris Toole from Teamsters on talking about contract negotiations for your deputies. Where does that stand now, 2 months later, a little bit into 2019 here?
So, you know, Paul Markowitz, the president of Teamsters 118, Chris Toole, the lead negotiator, I've had good conversations with both of them. But I just have to say that this is kind of like a triangle, okay? And you know, you have the deputies that are looking to be made whole. They haven't had a contract, it ran out in 15. And then you have the taxpayers and our constituents, the Board of Supervisors. So if you take that triangle of those three entities, I'm right smack in the middle. So, you know, sometimes the supervisors are saying, hey, look, I'm leaning more towards the deputies. The deputies are saying, hey, look, I'm, you know, leaning more towards the supervisors. I'm looking to put, you know, more police officers on the road and get a fair contract for the deputies. But I will say, during this whole time, their contract ran out in 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, and going forward, these deputy sheriffs have been just superior law enforcement officers and are doing their job professionally, even though they don't have a current contract.
Now, obviously, that's not the only, it isn't, not really unique, the situation that Wayne County finds itself in. Obviously, generally across policing, we're seeing a lot of reports about shortages, not as many folks being interested, young people, not as many taking tests as we were talking about before we came on the air here. Talk a little bit about that and the shortage and what kind of challenge that puts or burden that puts on you guys.
Yeah, so just to go back to the first question, our last meeting was probably the most productive. And what I've continued to say is, look, we need to keep talking and we'll come up with an agreement that people are, I think, fair. And fair is, you know, fair is kind of a subjective word, you know, depending on what seat you're sitting in. But again, I want to put more deputy sheriffs on the road. I want to make sure that they're paid equitably. And again, you know, that's a subjective thing. I will say that moving forward, it's going to be very difficult for all law enforcement agencies, whether you're the city of Rochester, the state police, the town and village police departments, or the sheriff's offices, because people taking civil service tests to get into law enforcement has dropped significantly. For example, our last corrections officers test, we used to have 150 to 175 people take that test. We had 31. Our deputy sheriff test would be 175 to 200 people. We had 83. Now, that's just not a Wayne County issue. That's an issue all across New York State that is a problem. So that's going to be, as we go forward, to recruit and retain people, as long as the economy stays good, people want to work in the private sector. When the economy goes bad, people want to work in the government sector. So again, just kind of this cycles. We'll have to work our way through this, but hopefully We will. And again, I'm not looking to lower the standards of the Wayne County Sheriff's Office. We're an accredited agency. All four of our divisions, again, court security, civil, the jail facility, and our police services, our deputy sheriffs, we're all accredited. I'm not looking to lower our standards just to fill spots. I want to be able to stay a premier law enforcement agency. So we'll get through this, but it's going to be difficult. And again, it takes a lot of time, you know, to process people, to hire people.
I was going to say, it isn't necessarily as easily as you guys just sort of walking out and hiring some folks. It's a process. There's months of waiting, I would imagine. Talk a little bit about what you see as sort of what could potentially be a timeline. Obviously, you don't know how long or what or how it's all going to come together. But as the people come back around toward policing as a viable career, as something they want to do, especially young people, what's that look like?
So here's what happens. The training alone with the academy and our field training is 9 months, all right? So once we hire a person, we have 9 months before they can work independently day one. All right, now let's back that up. They take the civil service test. They pass the civil service test. Then, you know, a month, 6 weeks after that, they have to take a physical agility test. That knocks out about half. After they pass the physical agility test, then we do a background investigation. We have an investigator that, you know, checks their neighbors, their finances, all kinds of things that we do a background investigation. Then we go to the polygraph. They sit down there and bare their souls, good or bad, of what they've done. And what we're looking for is truthfulness and integrity, okay? And then after the polygraph examination, they take a written psychological test. After the written psychological test, after they pass that, they sit down with a psychiatrist or a psychologist. They bare their soul to that individual for an hour. We go through all those processes, and then we pick the most qualified applicants out of the people that passed all those. We hire those folks, and then they have to go through 9 months of training before they work day one independently. I don't know of any other position in a county, in our county workforce, or any county workforce, where you put that much time and energy into an employee.
And doesn't that really speak to the quality of the people you end up having at your disposal, though?
You know, absolutely. That's why, you know, we vet our people so well. That's another reason why other departments, you know, look to recruit some of our deputy sheriffs, because we do such a great vetting process and we do such a great training process.
So to that end, how do you avoid, and this is something that I think I've seen some other counties have to sort of battle with a little bit, how do you avoid allowing Wayne County or any more rural county to become sort of a training ground or a training facility for some of those larger, more urban or maybe state agencies?
So I'll speak of my colleagues as sheriffs, okay? You know, a police chief is appointed by, you know, the village or town board. He or she answers to the village or town board. That's okay. That's the way those systems are set up. They provide great and stellar service. But a county sheriff is a little different. We're co-employers, okay? So the Board of Supervisors or the legislatures, whatever government you have set up in your county, in Wayne County, we're a Board of Supervisors. I submit a budget, and then the board votes on the budget. I get the appropriations from the county, all right, the budget from the county, line item, okay? But I decide, as sheriff, what the task duties and functions of our employees are. So I point the direction of the sheriff's office, you know, what work we'll do, what work we won't do, all right? So it's a little difficult because some of our shortages, I actually blame myself because of my aggressiveness to provide such great services. You know, the Village Alliance dissolved. They had a police department. I decided that it would be in the best interest of the county to put on 8 more deputy sheriffs, not for Lyons itself, but to keep response times across the county consistent and to make sure our response was quick. There's a state police barracks right there in Lyons of what was the village, now the hamlet. They could have got every call because we were closest car concept like all the other counties are, which means is the fringe and the outlying towns of the county would suffer because services, whether sheriff's deputies or state police, would have to go to Lyons to pick up the slack of the calls. So again, those 8 deputies that we put on were not an added expense to the county because I had reduced the corrections officer staff by 8, took the money from those 8 corrections officers that I reduced, shifted it over to the road patrol, all by resolution. So the true cost to the taxpayer was about $500,000, all right? So again, my aggressiveness with the welfare fraud unit and partnering with Josh McCrossin down at the Department of Social Services. I have a sergeant and a deputy down there to work on welfare fraud and also assist the child protective workers in their work down there. So that's what we've got 10. And then we've put on school resource officers, two in Wayne Central, one at the BOCES building, one in SOTUS. A second one was added to North Rose Woolcott. One started in Red Creek on January 1st. We've got one in Clyde Savannah, and I have a sergeant to do that. So it's my aggressiveness. And because it takes such a long period of time to get a deputy sheriff from the time they take the test to the time that they go through the training to work independently, we're running about a year and a year and a half behind to fill these spots. So again, as we've increased our services to the communities, to the schools, all right, we continue to be behind. Now, my hope is that we're going to get caught up. I started out with 14 in the school, Basic Academy, that started February. Two have already left. Or one has left the academy, one that we did a transfer left. So now we're down again. But again, all our full-time vacancies on the road patrol are filled. The problem is 10 of them are in school, and I'm not going to get their services to work independently until probably late October or November of this year.
So then sort of piggybacking off of that, you alluded to it a little bit, but the sheer size of Wayne County, obviously it's a big rural county. Is that part of the challenge too, making sure that you are everywhere you have to be having to play that sort of game of checkers to make sure that everyone is represented fairly?
Well, again, we're a closest car county with the state police, and like every other county around us. I've asked the state police to be a little more consistent in their scheduling so we could do things out. Because of their collective bargaining agreement, they're not able to do that. So again, I try to put more deputy sheriffs on the street. That makes our patrol areas smaller. That makes our response times quicker. It's better for officer safety. That's one of the rubs with our current contract negotiations. You know, I want to have scheduling efficiencies. And right now, the Teamsters and the deputies don't want to change the schedule that they're on.
So we talked about it a little bit earlier, a lot of heavy, tough cases you guys have had over the last 2 years. What are some of the things that folks in law enforcement do to take care of themselves? Obviously, some people outside of law enforcement might think that it's just a matter of you walk away from a scene and suddenly you're not thinking about it anymore, but these issues all build and they all wear and you don't forget. So what's that process look like for your folks and how you manage those situations?
So people need respite, okay? And that's one of my concerns of wanting to go to either an 8 or an 8.5 hour shift to get off our 10-hour shifts, because that leads deputies to working 15-hour shifts. Look, we don't even let truck drivers in the state drive 11 hours, more than 11 hours. And now I have to force deputy sheriffs, okay, to work extended hours beyond 12 hours. Now, if we get a major case, look, all bets are off. We got to do what we've got to do. You know, the deputies and the criminal investigators over the weekend started Friday afternoon. They worked around the clock until Friday night. We had that kidnapping robbery case. Mm-hmm. All right. So sometimes you got to sprint. But overall, we need to reduce the number of hours that we're working per day. I want our deputies to have time off, but I don't want them to work 4 days, 12 and 15, 10, 12, 15 hours a day, and then they have 3 days off. They need respite every single day, okay? Because they're constantly under pressure when they're on duty. Officer safety is paramount, all right? You know, we need to take a little better care. We need to eat better. We need to drink more water. You know, we need to exercise. I could probably drop 25, 30 pounds myself. I have a problem where I never say no to anyone, to try to get to places. But again, we just need to take care of our families. We need to take care of ourselves. And that leads to, again, a superior, paramount services that we can give to our communities.
So let's switch gears a little bit. Talk about some of the state initiatives, some of the things that have been popping up from Albany. Let's start with the mugshots. Mugshot and police report system change that Governor Cuomo would like to see. Obviously not as introduced. We've seen a little bit of change, so maybe now it'll only affect state agencies, but obviously, I would assume something that you guys are also watching.
Well, I would say, you know, right now, how we operate, when we arrest somebody, we release the mugshot and we release a small narrative of what the details are of what happened. The governor wants it so no press releases go out and no mugshots go out. All right, this is where I say that, you know, Albany ought to have a conversation with sheriffs, okay, with the New York State Sheriff's Association. I was the past president of the New York State Sheriff's Association in 18. I think rather than doing a wholesale change of this, why don't we just add that, hey, look, the courts have the responsibility or the district attorneys have the responsibility once a case is disposed of or a plea bargain that they have to do a press release in the paper to show people what's been done. I think it's important to have the booking photo and a brief thing because then people are aware of what's going on in their neighborhoods or what could go on. I don't think that law enforcement wants to operate in secrecy. So we're not going to say who we arrested or what we did. I think a good balance would be is, whether it be the district attorney's office or the courts, hey, let's do a follow-up once a case is disposed of and say, hey, look, a person got arrested for assault in the second degree, but they pled guilty to assault in the third degree. Or they got arrested for assault third and they pled guilty to harassment. I think that makes everybody more accountable all the way through the process. And the other thing it does, it still gives the people that we represent, our constituency, and our taxpayers, the ability to know what we're doing and what's going on.
So, obviously, it sort of seems like you see it as a matter of transparency, as a matter of being able to continue doing the work you're doing well. To that end, would this not, in some ways, increase suspicion among those who think police aren't doing just work? We see pockets of that.
Oh, I would say absolutely. If we're going to, I'm totally against this. If we're going to work in secrecy. Now, when I talk about work in secrecy, well, you know, we start many investigations that don't pan out. The allegations aren't true, right? But we don't publicize those allegations, false allegations, unless we make an arrest that somebody falsely did those accusations. Look, the whole system is based upon being truthful. Mm-hmm. The whole system. So again, I know you're innocent until proven guilty, but I think taxpayers and our constituency have a right to know what we're doing. Again, if we're doing an investigation, I'm not going to stand in front of the microphone and tell you, hey, we're interviewing this person. But once we've made an arrest, I think it's important to tell the public what we've done, how we've done it, okay? We've done it within our rules and regulations, and then they have that knowledge. They have that power of that knowledge. They can decide on themselves what they do. But then the end product, if the governor wants to change it, to make it so, hey, look, how was the case disposed of? Was it totally dismissed and the person was innocent? Was it a hung jury? How was it? I think those things need to be reported. I think that would be a good compromise.
So another item that's popped up, obviously it doesn't impact you directly, I don't think, but the calling for closure of three state prisons potentially by September, obviously we don't really know any specifics. But to that end, is that... moving in that direction, is that necessarily a good thing?
I will disagree with that. I disagreed when the governor closed four prisons, I think back in 12. He closed four prisons. The capacity of those four prisons that he closed previously were the same number of parole violators that we're holding in jail. Now, that's the issue that I have, the parole violators. Probably 10% of our population is parole violators, maybe more now, but that's a cost that's shifted to the counties for their health care costs, for their mental health costs, all right? Now listen, I hate to say this, a jail facility is like a hotel, all right? You got so many rooms, you got to have so much staff to do that, whether you've got one person or whether you're full, you still have to do it. The meals are, you know, $4.50, $5 a day. Right, the big lift is the mental health services and the health care services of what has to be done. Counties are stuck doing that. So when he says that he's going to close more prisons, take the burden off the counties for house and parole violators. Take that responsibility back. They're on New York State parole. If they violate parole or they commit an offense, all right, that led to their violation of parole, take them back, put them in state prison. When they got to come to court, we'll come and get them and take them back and forth, but don't make us house them. All right. So again, that's my objective, all right, of closing more prisons.
Mm-hmm. So to that end, bail reform. This is something that seems to come up, or it seems to have come up every year in the last 2 or 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know what types of changes fully will be implemented, but the prospect of some sort of change probably pretty real at this point. What are you guys watching as a point of concern or point of contention when bail reform comes up?
So the philosophy of bail reform, I totally agree with, okay? Now here's where it gets murky of how you're going to implement it. So let's take example, you and I commit a crime together, okay? Your family has the money to bail you out. My family doesn't have the money to bail me out, so I sit in jail until my case is disposed of. We're the same threat to public safety,
right?
Okay? I agree with that. However, when they say nonviolent felonies, there'll be no bail. So what we've seen is you're either going to be in jail or you're going to be out of jail, all right? And which means you're going to be held with no bail or you're going to be out. And what they've talked about is nonviolent felonies. Well, robbery second's a nonviolent felony, mm-hmm. All right? Burglary second's a nonviolent felony, all right? Criminal sale of drugs and narcotics is nonviolent. Domestic violence, they would go see a judge like that. But again, I think, the concept is good, but I think there still needs to be judicial discretion, because we want to make sure that victims are protected and we want to make sure that public safety overall is protected in our communities. So again, I think the concept is noble. We just got to see how it works out and what happens.
Mm-hmm. So then, sort of recapping off something that's happened in the last couple of years, a change that's happened, raise the age. Good, bad, indifferent, noticeable change, unnoticeable change. What's sort of been the temperature of that one?
So again, I agreed with the science and philosophy of raise the age. You know, all of us, we did things when we were 16 or 17 that we wouldn't think of doing today, and probably things that we did at 16 and 17, myself back in the 70s, wouldn't think of doing today, but we mature, okay? There's studies that say the human brain doesn't fully mature until 24 years of age, okay? So I signed on with a few sheriffs. My friend, Alan Riley, who was sheriff of Madison County at the time, he was put on the governor's task force for this. I signed on to this. At the time, Senator Nozzolio and Assemblyman Bob Oaks weren't too happy with me. But I said again, in science and philosophy, I agree with this. Mm-hmm. So how's it shook out? We've had one individual since it came into effect last year. That we had to put into a juvenile holding center. We've had one. We don't hold 16-year-olds in the jail anymore. This fall, it'll be 17-year-olds. It's been somewhat of a change, all right, and people don't like change, but I think it's probably changed for the better. Now, some of my law enforcement colleagues that have, maybe the city of Rochester or some of the suburbs of Rochester might disagree with that. For us, it hasn't been a huge lift. Okay. We still have the ability to prosecute youth as adults under certain violent crimes. Okay. But the science and philosophy, I absolutely agree with. It's 16 and 17-year-olds. Now, do they need to be accountable? Yeah. But I also get this. So a 16 or a 17-year-old gets a criminal record in New York State, all right, and then they try to go to college out of state or try to get a license. Now they can't because they've got a conviction. All right, where other states don't have that. So, again, it's kind of a balancing act. I don't see it as a huge, heavy lift. It has been a change in how we've had to do our business, but we've managed to do what we've needed to do.
So when you're talking about those 16, 17-year-olds, or even some folks a little bit younger than that, the resource officer, the school resource officer programs that have been instituted across the board seem to be making pretty astounding progress. Talk about your experience in Wayne County with the RSO program.
So I've always said that prevention is a very difficult thing to put a number on, okay? And it's difficult to sell in your budget to legislatures because they're always looking for a cost analysis of how much are we going to save and how much is it going to cost. We were blessed in Wayne County, okay, that the state police from 2005 to 2009 had a COPS grant from the federal government. They had 100 school resource officers all across the state. We were very fortunate in Wayne County to have 7 troopers that were school resource officers in our 11 school districts, okay? Some shared a school resource officer, some didn't want a school resource officer. The funding went away in 2009. The state police redeployed their troopers to do other things. I took this upon myself that every single school needs a school resource officer, and I don't care what uniform they wear, okay? If the school's in a village and the school wants to do business with the village PD, that's great, okay? With the town PD, that's great, or with the sheriff's deputy. I don't care who it is, but I want a uniform in there. In Wayne County, 15,000 people, students and staff go to our schools, our most vulnerable sites of where we send our children and where people go to work, all right? And it's not just about having a cop in the school with a gun. And I've told the Board of Supervisors and I've told the school superintendents, if you're just looking for somebody there with a gun, go hire a security guard. I'm not interested in just being a gun in your school. What I want is to prevent things from happening. The school is still responsible for student discipline, but I want to become a partner, okay? If a kid's not coming to school and they're truant, what's going on in the household? Let's get whoever's responsible, the counselor, the attendance person. Let's put the deputy and that person in the car. Let's go out to that house. Let's figure out what's going on. Let's get that student back in school so they're productive, because that is eventually going to morph into, we're going to have law enforcement there because something's going on in that house that shouldn't be going on in that house. Now, is it disciplined? Is it something else? All right. But we need to find out. Also, good interactions with law enforcement and students, okay? It's very important that our school resource officers, when those kids get off the bus, during lunchtime, and when those kids get back on the bus, that we're around those kids. Many times those children are telling our school resource officers, hey, there's going to be a party here, or this happening, and we can stop a lot of things from happening. This is happening on social media. This person's getting bullied, okay? A lot of prevention is going on. I'll just take an example. In Williamson alone, we had a school resource officer there in 16 and 17. The school superintendent the year before, I think he had 6 superintendent hearings. The year we were there, he had 0. The year after we left and they decided that they didn't want to do a school resource officer, he's had several. So it does work. Now I have aggressively, all right, and again, this goes back to some of the reasons that we're short. I have aggressively pushed this program. In 10 to 14, we had one in a Grant and SOTUS. That ran out. Then in 15, North Rose Wolcott did a school resource officer. We did some one-day school resource officers things with Palmyra, Wayne Central, and SOTUS, all right? But last year, we made a big push in September. Wayne Central put on 2 school resource officers. The BOCES campus in Williamson put on a school resource officer 12 months a year. SOTUS put on a school resource officer. North Rose Wolcott put on a 2nd school resource officer. Clyde Savannah put on a school resource officer. January 1st of this year, Red Creek put in a school resource officer from the sheriff's office. And I also added a sergeant to administer that program and work with the school resource officers and be the liaison between the sheriff's office and the school resource officers, okay? So again, you know, I've had to pluck 6, 7, 8 people out of our road patrol to put in these school resource officers. Again, it's going to take us over a year to catch up that lag. Mm-hmm. So again, my aggressiveness to provide services, efficient services, has kind of caused my staffing problems. I take full responsibility of that. But it's important that we provide services to the 15,000 most vulnerable people, our students and our staffs that go to these school buildings. It's very important. I don't want to be standing in a microphone and explaining, okay, why we had an incident there. I would like to prevent that incident, having that Wayne County Sheriff's Office patrol vehicle out in front of that school. So if somebody does have an idea, oops, somebody's here, let's not do it.
Yep. So to that end, probably one of the more controversial items, or at least it seemed more black and white and who supports and who does not, legalization of marijuana, easily been the one getting the most attention as far as proposals out of Albany go. Your thoughts on it, obviously I believe you are opposed to it, but just sort of give our audience a little bit of context there as to why you are.
So I am opposed to it. I have testified twice in front of the New York State Assembly, once in New York City in January, and then last fall in Binghamton to a committee of New York State Assembly members. Look, it's being framed, all right, and this is being very simplistic. It's being framed of a couple people sitting on a couch in their home, watching a movie, smoking a couple joints, and ripping the refrigerator door off, and having a good old time. Mm-hmm. It's much more complicated than that. All you got to do is look at Denver. All right, read the Denver study, okay? Did they get more revenue? I just read over the weekend, I think they had $6 billion since they've done it in revenue and in taxes. But for every dollar they take in, they're spending $4 on services, okay? So let's just talk about law enforcement, okay? Accidents in Colorado have gone up 20%, okay, related to drugs, all right? Homelessness, DSS services, all those types of things. Again, I'm not against medical marijuana. I understand that. But the legalization of marijuana, and people are going to say, well, it's no different than alcohol. Look at all the problems alcohol causes us, okay? Domestic violence, things on the road, okay? And I'm not against people that drink, believe me, okay, in moderation. But don't get behind the wheel of a car and drive and put someone else at risk. You know, don't get all jacked up and abuse people. So again, I think we just need to slow this down. You know, the Medical Society in New York is against it. The mental health directors of New York State are against this. I know that the police chiefs are against this. I know that the sheriffs are against this. All we're saying is, look, slow this down. Okay, and we need to take more time to research this. Just don't think about the revenue, and because, hey, everybody else is doing it around us, so we should do it. Look at the Denver study. Please look at the Denver study.
And is that too simplistic of an approach? It seems like for those who do support legalization, they tend to look at the economic impact or the positive, the revenue that would come in. Or, as Governor Cuomo said a couple weeks ago, the revenue that would be lost to businesses and entrepreneurs who want to do this and go to another state.
Well, one of my concerns was it's either Vermont or New Hampshire has a law where you can have, you know, a couple mature plants and a couple immature plants and you can grow your own versus Denver has a dispensary system. I definitely don't want it where people can do their own stuff because you don't know what's going to be contaminated and what isn't going to be contaminated because, look, most people aren't going to grow their own. They're going to buy it from somebody else. But here's the other issue. Okay, you buy a couple joints from somebody. That couple joints came from, you know, 20, 30 joints. That 20 or 30 joints came from, you know, a nickel bag or a quarter of a pound, which leads to a pound, which a pound leads to a ton, and a ton leads to, you know, illegal, growing and distribution of marijuana, okay? Now, if you go to the dispensary sale like Colorado did, what you're going to see is the dispensary stuff, yeah, a lot of money, okay? But it's very expensive. So now you're going to see the black market is going to pick up, and there's going to be more sales outside of the dispensaries, which is going to be contaminated. All right, and you don't know where it came from, other than it has been produced illegally, sold illegally, cartels in the Denver area in Colorado. So there's a whole lot of issues. So all we're saying is, look, pump the brakes. Mm-hmm. Pump the brakes on this, and let's look at this a little longer, do a little more research, and come up with something that might be a little more palatable. I get when they do the poll, 63 or 68% of the people say, hey, look, it's no big deal. Well, let's go back to 95 and 96 when the synthetic opiates came out. Our hospital stays went from 10 to 14 days to maybe 2 days, or, hey, here's a bottle of 90, go home and manage your own pain. In the mid-90s is when we saw all the little smiley faces in our doctor's office. Where's your pain? Mm-hmm. So, again, where are we at with that? I just don't want to say 10 years, 12 years down the road, you know, why the heck did we do that? Look at the problems it's caused. Look, we're in the middle of, you know, an opioid epidemic, which we're making progress on. You know, we've already got issues with alcohol. Again, alcohol used properly and appropriately isn't a big deal. Probably marijuana used properly and appropriately isn't a big deal. But there's all kinds of peripheral issues that go with that. So let's just pump the brakes, slow it down, and do a little more scientific research on it.
So last question for you. You mentioned it just a second ago, the heroin epidemic. Making progress.
Yep.
Optimism there?
I do see optimism with that. You know, I have said that that is a addiction. That is a problem that's going to intimately affect every single individual. You will intimately know someone that has been affected by heroin, whether in your family or a friend or a colleague. But I think we're making progress. Again, you know, a lot of the heroin is people started with a opioid with a script from a doctor. They had it legally, all right? And then all of a sudden they got cut off. They still have the pain. They didn't, you know, get help for withdrawals or whatever. Then they go to the street stuff. Mm-hmm. And again, you know, laced with fentanyl, carfentanil and things like that, the overdoses. But I think we are making progress. One great thing that I have a great partnership with Jim Heights and the Wayne Behavioral Health Network. He's opened up an open access center from 7 o'clock in the morning to 10 o'clock at night, looking to push that to 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, where somebody can go in, get services right then and there when they're at the lowest point of their lives, get a bed to get into rehab, okay? Because what happens is somebody hits their low point, they want to make an appointment, now they got to wait 2 weeks for their appointment. Yeah. And then it would be months before they get in. Well, they've cycled through and now they're not interested.
Right.
So you got to get somebody when they're at their lowest point. And in Wayne County with the Open Access Center, you know, Jim Heights and that Wayne Behavioral Health Network staff has done a fabulous job with that.
All right. Well, appreciate the time and best of luck continuing forward through 2019.
I appreciate it. I hope it slows down a little bit, calls for service wide. We will get this contract settled. It's not in anyone's interest to go to binding arbitration. So I try to keep very positive and just trying to keep nudging everybody together. So let's get a deal. And then the deputies and the corrections officers are doing great work. And I appreciate all the staff at the Sheriff's Office.
Hey, guys, thanks for listening to my conversation with Wayne County Sheriff Barry Virts. Just a reminder, our Sunday conversations are available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, and Stitcher, in addition to our YouTube channel. We will be back next week with another episode, but until then, stay tuned to FingerLakes1.com for the latest breaking news around the region. Bye now.